This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
America itself has to kind of reckon with itself and determine what is America's relationship to Black people.
While history books will largely remember 2020 as the year of a global pandemic, it was also the year that Americans began to truly embrace the Black Lives Matter movement. The murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and most recently the verdict in the shooting of Jacob Blake, brought about an outpouring of support in a year where there were only 18 days when police did not kill someone. We turn the page on 2020 on Sea Change Radio by revisiting two of our discussions about the Black experience in this country. First, we hear from my friend Castle Redmond, a managing director at the California Endowment, as he talks about growing up Black in the Bay Area in the 70s. Then, a conversation with my high school friend Maurice Plains about the relationship between police and Black America. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my good friend, Castle Redmond. Castle, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Our listeners may recognize Castle's voice for some of the voiceover work he's done in the past. We've been friends for about 20 years, but I wanted to have you on today to talk about what's happening in America since the George Floyd murder. First, why don't you tell us a little bit about your current position and how it's relevant to this discussion about race.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Alex. Despite some of the craziness going on and in the world right now, there are rays of incredible hope. And I'm very inspired by what's going on in the streets right now. My name is Castle Redmond. I work for the California Endowment. We're a health foundation. We are the largest state-focused foundation in the country. I oversee our statewide Boys and Men of Color portfolio. So our mission is to improve the health of Californians and to increase access to health care for all Californians. And that really, to do that, we have to focus very heavily on those whose outcomes are the poorest. Folks who have had the least access to health care and whose health outcomes are at the bottom. And we found that those run along racial lines. And it's the same racial lines that were there when this racial hierarchy was created at our founding, at really in 1619, when the first slaves were brought and when we began to take land from the Native folks here.
And before the California Endowment, what did you do?
Before the California Endowment, I ran juvenile reentry. I started the first juvenile reentry program in Oakland, California. So I oversaw making sure that every young person coming out of juvenile hall with an Oakland address was enrolled in school within 3 days and had a case manager assigned to them to help them get through.
Before we go to the rays of hope that we're seeing, let's talk about some of the shards or the shattered glass of anger that most of us feel when we see something like the brutal murder on camera of George Floyd. Why do you think this moment was different in some ways?
For two reasons. I think number one, it's this has been building over time, especially since Ferguson. And community organizers have been working on racial justice issues more collaboratively since then. Black Lives Matter has really been those folks, Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, have done an incredible amount of work with many, many other organizers to get ready for this moment. That's number one. Number two is that was the worst video I think any of us have ever seen. That was a public execution over 9 minutes that we had to watch on film, and it was conducted by the state. It was the police who were supposed to protect us who did that. And it was a horrible, horrible thing to watch. And I think that woke a lot of people up. And we talk about being woke. It's a being awake to that reality, that thing that happens, that they happened on camera while they knew they were being filmed and still did it.
And it wasn't just a one guy acting.
It was three others who stood by and watched, other law enforcement officers. And this person right here with, 20 complaints against him already, was a training officer. He was a man, they put him in a place of authority. That's how the system, that's how off the system and the culture have gotten. It's not about one person. And it's not about police officers are evil or they're all bad or they're all racist. It's not about an individual. But we have to really look at the whole system. That's why they call it systemic racism.
And it's not just police either. It comes from the top down. I mean, we have a racist in the White House, but we also have a whole movement of white supremacy that we haven't really seen since Jim Crow America.
Yeah, since Jim Crow. I mean, my father grew up in the Jim Crow South. You know, he's a sharecropper.
Yeah, why don't we, before we dive more into the present, why don't you tell us a little bit more about growing up in a black and white household in the East Bay?
Yeah, so my mother's Jewish. She's white and Jewish, and my father's black. My father's from North Carolina, Tarboro, North Carolina, and my grandfather, Jake, they were sharecroppers and before they moved into town. So my father was born on a sharecropping farm prior to that, it had been a plantation, right? So they grew up picking cotton and tobacco. You know, it's very similar to being undocumented and working the fields here in California. And so that legacy, we're still exploiting and demonizing people today in very similar ways to the way we did it then, although we try to pretend that it's different. So it's something that we have to really take a hard look at and really look in the mirror, and I think that's what people are finally doing right now.
You told me once when we were talking about race in a offhand way, I forgot, you were saying it doesn't matter if your mom's white and your dad's black, you're black.
Yeah, I'm black. I'm not half anything. I'm black. I mean, that's America, though. That's the way it's always been in America. So, I mean, when we had a segregated baseball, for instance, there, if you looked out to other countries to find out, if you went to Cuba to find a baseball player, the question they asked was, you know, was there any black blood? If there's any black blood in you, then you play in the Negro Leagues. Right, so that's the legacy of our entire country, one drop rule, and so that certainly applied to me and my upbringing. Wasn't something my parents had to instill in me; is what America instilled. That's what it told me.
And explain what redlining is and what your folks had to do to buy a house in Castro Valley back in the late '60s, early '70s.
The '70s. Yeah, it was in the '70s when I was a kid. We moved from South Hayward, which was a mixed neighborhood, but it was a neighborhood that black people could live in, to Castro Valley, where the town my mother was from, actually. And the real estate agent, you know, told my parents that they couldn't, they didn't sell to black people in that neighborhood. And so this is on the, just after the civil rights movement, really. So it's in the '70s. And so that was the era, you know, like with the play A Raisin in the Sun, where we weren't allowing folks to tell us where we could and couldn't move. So you did whatever you could to integrate, essentially. So my mother went and got my grandmother, and the two of them bought the house, and then we moved in.
Pistol shots ring out in a barroom night. Enter Betty Valentine from the upper hall. She sees a bartender in a pool of blood. Cries out, my God, they've killed them all. Here comes the story of the hurricane. The man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell, but one time he could have been the champion of the world.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
So that was the dulcet tones of Castle Redman doing his Sea Change Radio spot back, I don't know, 10 years ago for our listeners. I'm speaking now live with Castle Redman, who's a program manager at the California Endowment. So Castle, you mentioned how this all goes back to 1619, and I think that's an important jumping off point for any kind of debate about what we're seeing right now in terms of the backlash from not only the George Floyd murder, but the backlash against the protests against it, the right-wing talking point that, you know, the looting and the violence is much worse than what the police had perpetrated. Obviously, when we see video of some kids, black, white, doesn't matter, smashing windows and grabbing radios or whatever from a window, it makes us think that that's not productive. But maybe you can kind of put that anger into a little bit more historical context for us.
Yeah, I mean, no one wants that. No one likes to see that. And yet we have to understand that's always been part of it. And our country was founded on that, on those kinds of uprisings, on really riots. You know, the Tea Party was a riot and involved looting. The Boston Massacre was a riot. And it was conducted by people who called themselves patriots and sons of liberty, and they're remembered as heroes, the founders of our country. And what they really did was they got drunk and they went and started to harass the law enforcement of the day, which was a British soldier, because they were angry at a corrupt leader, a king, a corrupt king. And they ended up rioting and looting and getting shot.
Because they were breaking the law.
Because they were breaking the law at the time. And they had conflict with police at the time, which were British soldiers. So this is always, it's part of all uprisings like this. They were looting.
So what would you say to somebody who thinks that the looting is worse than the status quo?
They're not paying attention because, first of all, the protests out there right now, folks, there are hundreds of thousands, millions of people in the street daily, weekly, without that right now. So that's actually a small part of what was going on that got a lot of news coverage, number one. And number two, state violence is always worse. We give a lot of power to the state to police us, the power to kill. And if they abuse that power, that's worse than one of us on the street doing something that we're not supposed to do, breaking the law, property crime. And then lastly is that looting has always been part of uprisings, including those done by our founding fathers that created this nation, the people we consider to be heroes. They looted.
Just carrying on the tradition.
Carrying on the American way.
So you're intimately involved in education at all different levels. What are some of the ways that our various systems, like education, perpetuate inequity, and how do we help undo this?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, we have to look at all the systems. You know, they say that, you know, the impact of segregation, if we statistically eliminated segregation in America, we would eliminate all the inequitable outcomes in education, in health, in the justice system, and income and wealth. And so we have to understand that the roots of all of this were created by the laws that we implemented. And so when you have inequitable outcomes in education, suspension rates, high school graduation rates that run along those same racial lines that we segregated, demonized, and disinvested, then you're going to get outcomes that manifest themselves in all kinds of ways. And one of the most important ways is a disconnection from the American dream. I mean, James Baldwin said that, he said it well when we talked about the American dream and Black America. And if we have no connection to the American dream, then what's the point of going to school? What's the point of school at all? America itself has to kind of reckon with itself and determine what is America's relationship to Black people.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Castle Redmond. He is a senior program manager at the California Endowment. Yes, you hear to protect and to serve is kind of the national mission of law enforcement in this country. So many police departments have that written on right there on their police cars, but I think far too often law enforcement loses sight of who they're actually serving. They're not serving all of us. You know, they may be trying to protect some of us. When somebody is killing somebody over a counterfeit bill, like George Floyd, a $20 bill, he's lost sight of the mission statement of his organization by a long shot. He's not protecting.
Maybe
and
he
serving.
Never should have been there in the first place. Maybe he's the wrong guy, right? The wrong people. And they have a lot of the wrong people.
But it's a tough job, and you can see how people become so jaded. There's some great communities here in the East Bay, like Richmond, which has done some very progressive work in trying to change the culture of their law enforcement.
Yeah, I know in Richmond, the Rise Center in Richmond has done incredible work there, and I know they've been working with the police department. I know that Advanced Peace, which is now statewide national, began in Richmond out of the Office of Neighborhood Safety, that has worked directly with young men who are most likely to be shot or to shoot someone, and has had incredible results doing that kind of work. And so there are really ways to keep the public safe that are grounded in prevention, that are grounded in healing, that are grounded in youth development, you know, really working to keep folks, young people, out of the system, right? That includes interactions with law enforcement. Police officers themselves are asked to do things that they should not be asked to do. I actually think, you know, law enforcement, they should have social work backgrounds, not criminal justice backgrounds. And at the same time, there are so many things that can be done by community-based organizations that have to do, especially around mental health, you know, when officers should be called. I mean, they shouldn't be on school campuses. There are a lot of things we can do to limit interactions with police where this kind of stuff is going to happen. But I will say that who we recruit to become police officers and who we let in, who we let stay, has to be reexamined.
He's a program manager for the California Endowment, Castle Redmond. Castle, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
In the eyes of the maker.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my good friend Maurice Plains. He is the director of Scholars Advancement for Emerging Scholars, and he lives in the DC metro area. Maurice, it's a pleasure to have you on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here, sir.
Let's take a snapshot of where we are right now as a country, and you as an African-American man has seen since, it seems like every 5 to 10 years we have one of these shots across the bow. But this killing of George Floyd, maybe it's that we have such an uncaring president, but this seems to be different, doesn't it? Maybe you can kind of take us through your emotions, if you can, when you see something like that.
So I can answer this in several ways. What I like to do with my parents is I say to them, I'll answer as a professional, I'll answer as a parent, and then I'll answer on a personal level. Professionally, if I'm being honest, this is not surprising to see something like that. And when I have to speak to my scholars, if it does come up, you know, what I say to them is that the way that police handle, you know, African-Americans seemingly is, I guess the best words to use is, you know, without care. It doesn't seem like they're very careful with us. But the fact of the matter is that that is not something that I see changing. Even within the protests in and of themselves, you could see that if you're a hammer, then you treat everything like a nail. And maybe we're hoping that we can get a softer side of the police so that they don't have to, you know, hammer everything that's in front of them. So that's how I sort of say that in terms of the professional. In terms of being a parent, I'm a parent of a 25-year-old, also African-American male, who I have had, you know, everyone calls or says about the talk, but that's not a talk that happens once. That's a talk that happens every day that I'm with him. My son has been present with me when I've been pulled over by the police and harassed, you know, for no reason whatsoever. And there was one point, if I'm going to be honest, that I was pulled over by a police officer and he told me that I was the worst type of parent because of the music I was playing for my son at the time. I was really aghast because it says clearly on the front of it that there's a parental advisory. And I feel that if my son is going to listen to music like, you know, we were listening to, that it helps to me for me to be present there and sort of explain some of the nuances to it. But I didn't get to have that conversation on the side of the street. I was told and made to apologize to that police officer for behaving in such a fashion. I didn't really get to say to him how I really felt until we were in front of a judge and I was trying to argue my point to what I felt would be a more level-headed mind. So that would be as a parent. You know, if the definition of arrest is to stop, like you have cardiac arrest, you know, I've had at least 17 engagements where, you know, I've been stopped with the police. There's several times that I've had handcuffs placed on me. There's a number of times I've ended up behind bars, and there was one time where I ended up with a knee on my back. So this is just, you know, an experience that is day to day. You know, you and I were able to attend the same high school, and I had some encounters in that little town as well. With the police, with people that you know. One of the famous stories that goes through, you know, the lore of where we attend is that there was a young student who was accosted by a police officer and had his lacrosse stick taken from him while he was walking through town under the guise of him being a disturbing the peace, if you will. And that was me. That happened to myself and Kendall Price. You know Kendall. And, you know, it was the kind of thing that when it happened, he and I sort of shook it off like, you know, this happens all the time, you know. So what I guess I want your audience to understand is that when we see the video of a George Floyd, the surprising piece is that now we get to say, see, I told you. All right. And I don't think that's the first video. You know, we saw the Eric Garner video. We've seen a number of instances where you can't turn your head away and say that this is, you know, not maltreatment. But when you see that video, what I think is very poignant about the video is that there's a nonchalance about the police officers and what they're doing. It doesn't look like they're doing anything out of character for what would be their character. It was not even something that, you know, gave that officer concern. What I think is also telling is that you had a number of people who did look on and go, oh, my God, this is so unjust, and pulled up their cell phones and started to record, because in their eyes, what they were seeing was so, like I said, unjust and just out of the ordinary. But what I really think is the point that I bring home is that the story is that he had some other health issues, which, you know, caused the arrhythmia that he suffered. And that might be the case. But if he doesn't die in that situation, life goes on as normal. All right. And I think that that's one of the pieces that brings it home, is that you're watching a slow murder take place, and the utter nonchalance, the utter, you know, the method of how we do business is very glaring on that tape. This does not look like a one-off. This does not look like something that is not a process they don't do every single day. And again, I imagine that, you know, when I'm seeing that video, that George Floyd had, you know, maybe did the Rodney King, had been speeding down the highway at 120 miles an hour, high on drugs, and was a danger to himself and others. So to find out that, you know, the $20 bill that he was using might have not been legitimate, or, you know, let's say it was completely counterfeit, you know, for him to be treated in the manner where you don't see any resistance, but still the full tactical approach to subduing, you know, and maintaining his position is what they do as a normal arrest. So that, I think, is what the United States and people abroad have seen as, wow, this really is something that we cannot ignore. This is something that police officers do so often and so frequently that they're not even concerned at the optics, right? They didn't even get concerned that the video cameras came out. All you see is this officer conducting business as usual. And I think that becomes the big scary part of what we're watching.
So Maurice, has your perspective changed over the last 40-something years, or do you still view police in the same light?
I absolutely still view police in the same light. And I have to be able to say this out loud too, all right? I know not all police officers behave in this way, all right? I know that I've encountered just as many times with police where it has gone, you know, in my favor. I know that when I had my motorcycle stolen, I called the police. So I don't want you to think that there's this sort of adversarial hate relationship with police, but I will let you know that if you are a bad policeman, you can do a lot more damage than if you're a bad doctor, all right? Than if you're a bad lawyer, if you're a bad plumber or a bad electrician, all right?
And it's also worth noting, I remember hearing somebody say, when it came to the George Floyd killing, you can say, oh, it's just one bad cop. But when you have one bad cop acting terribly and let's say nine other cops not doing anything, you have 10 bad cops.
Correct. And what I think since, you know, since we've seen this is that what we found out is that two of those police officers were very new to the force. So they're getting, you know, basically the same sort of manual handed down to them. You know, one of them was on the job for 4 days and he's being taught that this is how we conduct business here. But the question I always pose is that why is it that, you know, given the diaspora of our country's, you know, diversity, why is it it's always African-Americans dying at the hands of police officers? You know, where's the Asian-Americans? Where are Native-Americans, Jewish-Americans? We could go through every demographic. It seems like we're the ones that are always losing our life to encounters with the police. And again, I'll say this. Your question was, do I see the police in any different light? I will go out of my way not to involve the police is the easiest way for me to say that.
Maurice Plains, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so very much, Alex Wise. I enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Wayne Shorter, Bob Dylan, and Daniel Lenoir.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.